All right, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in our lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. You gotta love AA. You know, you don't have last names, right? So I see the poster, and I see this Liz, and I think, I hope that's my Liz. You know, and you also claim people, you know. She used to come to the 930, which is my home group. I always loved it when she was there. You are in for a real treat. Liz works probably the strongest program of anybody I know, and knows the Big Book better than Bill Wilson, I bet. So here comes Liz.
Want a drink here.
I've got my phone. I don't see a clock in here, so I just want to be sure I don't go over or whatever. But my name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 20th, 1993. My home group is Fellowship of the Spirit, Big Book meeting on Saturday mornings at 10:30 up in Roswell, St. David's Episcopal Church. And I just want to thank Tim. I had seen Tim, I guess it was about, 6 weeks ago or so at a meeting, maybe. Couple months ago, I don't know. Time just kind of gets away from me. But I'd seen him, and he asked me if I would be willing to come up here and tell my story. And then he turned me on to the other Tim, and Tim emailed me or called me or texted me, and I said absolutely. I hadn't been up here in a while, and in fact, when I came here tonight, I passed it. I'm not used to coming in the dark here, so anyway, but I made it, and I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm starting to get a little cold, so I hope I can speak. But anyway, my job tonight is to tell a little bit about what my life used to be like, what happened, and what my life is like now. And, you know, I do want to say that if I didn't find something in these rooms to help with the problem that for so many years I did not know what I suffered from, I would still be searching. And I found the answer right here in Alcoholics Anonymous years ago. And that's what keeps me coming back, is because I found the answer. I found the answer here. And I think I might have, in my earliest recollections, I probably was looking for an answer. And, there was always something inside of me. I was painfully shy. From as far back as I can remember, painfully shy, there was always something inside of me that just felt like there was something wrong. I felt this anxiousness, this nervousness, and just apart. I didn't know how to connect with people. And, at school, it was painful because I did not know how to make friends. I went to good schools, but, I would always kind of hang around with the leftover kids, kids that didn't really fit into the, football, athletic stuff, and I didn't fit in with the cheerleader people, but I found this group of people that, just kind of were looking for other people, too, and, but I never formed any kind of lasting friendships in school, and as I got into middle school and high school, I guess in middle school. Well, at the end of the eighth grade is when I had my first experience with alcohol. And, again, feeling this constant nervousness and this constant anxious apartness from people, and just didn't feel like I fit anywhere, just followed me everywhere I went. And so when I went, I was getting ready. I graduated from eighth grade from a school here in Atlanta. And from there, everybody was going to go to different schools. So I went to a party, And there was a guy that I really, really liked, but I could never talk to him, you know. But in my mind, I married him like 8,000 times. But I remember he was going to go to that party, and that he was going to go to a different school. And back then, of course, there was no social media, no cell phones, none of that. And so I knew that that was probably going to be the last time I ever saw him. So anyway, I wanted to really go to that party. And we had a foreign exchange student living with us at the time. And my mom says, well, you can go if you take Tina. I'm like, shit, man. All right. So Tina and I, my mom drops us off in the wood panel station wagon at this party out in North Springs area. And I remember a friend of mine and the boy that I liked and another guy that she liked, they were kind of waiting outside, and they were like, you know, hey, we're not going in. We're going to go drink some beer. And here, you know, end of eighth grade, so what is that, about 13? So, I, you know, immediately I feel like, oh, my God, well, you know, I mean, we don't do that kind of stuff. And, but I wanted to be with them. I wanted to be with that guy. So I tell Tina, the foreign exchange student who barely spoke English, I said, you go on in, and I'll be back later. And, you know, I mean, think about that. I mean, that was, you know, my selfishness was definitely rampant back then, and I didn't know it. But anyway, I ended up going out with them, and we went, I don't know, behind an apartment complex or whatever, and I remember I only had a couple beers that night. I don't think they were the tall ones. I think it was just, you know, normal-sized beer. But I can remember the feeling that I had when I drank those beers. It was a feeling that I had never had before. You know, the big book in the doctor's opinion says that, you know, we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once from a few drinks. Well, I experienced that sense of ease and comfort that first time. You know, here I am with this guy that I like, could never talk to him in all the years that I was there at that school. But here I am that night, and I'm talking to him. And he's laughing with me, not at me. And, you know, we're just having a good old time. And I'm like, wow. Now, that I think that was, I saw him a couple years ago. His mom had passed away. She was one of my teachers. But I didn't see him since that night. But what was planted that night for me was the way that alcohol made me feel. And I absolutely loved it. When you're 13, 14 years old, it's kind of hard to go out and buy it, even though the drinking age back then was 18. So I did a lot of babysitting. My parents, they drank, but not a whole lot. But I remember just drinking anything, you know, anything. I didn't know how to mix drinks, but, you know, scotch or, you know, rum or beer, wine. I didn't care. And shortly thereafter, there was a girl that lived in my neighborhood, and her dad, she found out her dad was dealing drugs. So I was introduced to drugs shortly after I started drinking. And, you know, you put the two together, like, whoa, this is even better. And I continued to do that throughout my drinking career also. But drinking was a constant. The drugs were sporadic, but the drinking was definitely a constant. And, you know, my drinking caught up with me very quickly, because by the time I was, my parents had sent me to a private school for high school. And by the end of the 10th grade, they said, you know, she's not our kind of material. My mom and dad were devastated. You know, and that's one thing, too, that I feel like part of my alcoholism, it's an earmark of my alcoholism, where I was always trying to get by. Just get by. Just the bare minimum, you know. I never applied myself at school, and I carried that through in my life. I try to do my best now, and when I fall short of that, I feel that. You know, but back then it was just the norm, just to kind of get by. But there was also the part of me too that liked living on the edge. So when I was drinking, when I was a teenager, it was like getting away with something. You know, I felt really like, hey, this is kind of cool. You know, and you know, of course, I was having a good time. But, you know, having many conversations with my mom, even now, she's like, you know, that was hell for, you know, my sister was going through the same thing that I was. We were 14 months apart, and then we discovered we were in that kind of lifestyle together, you know, at the same time. And she's like, oh, you do this, you do that, you drink, yeah? So we started, you know, doing a lot of that stuff together. But, you know, it was hell on wheels for my parents. My mom, you know, we got to the point where we weren't coming home at night. you know, if we go out on a Friday night, my mom would expect us to come home on that same Friday night. And, no, I wouldn't roll in until sometimes Sunday, Monday, whatever. And, you know, again, we didn't have cell phones back then. My mom would be having the same clothes on that she had on 3 days before because she was worried sick. And then when we would get home, or I would get home, she didn't know whether to kill me or hug me to death. You know, she, you know, because all weekend, and my little brother, who when I went and made amends to him, he's 6 years younger than me, and, you know, he told me, he said, you know, I never wanted to have people come and spend the night because I never knew what the condition of the house was going to be. Are y'all going to roll in at 3 in the morning? Are y'all going to be wasted? Is there going to be a battleground in the house? You know, I mean, we would yell so loud that, you know, my mom would have to shut the windows. And it was, you know, we'd be running out of the house. And, I mean, it was just a unbelievable. So anyway, by the time I was 17, still in high school, my parents finally said, you know what, we can't put up with this anymore. You either start abiding by our rules or get out. I'm like, you know, deuces, I'm out. And I left. I thought, I don't want people telling me what to do. But I wanted to live off someone. I didn't want the responsibility. But anyway, I gathered my belongings in a trash, you know, big old black trash bag, and off I went. And I started living with people until they would get tired of me, and then I'd have to go live with someone else and someone else. I mean, I wasn't even out of high school yet. And finally, by the time, and I, you know, I had enough credits from the private school that I had gone to, so I could graduate early. My mom said, no, I want you to walk with your class. So in June or whatever it was when we had graduation, my mom had bought me a dress. I wasn't living at home. And she said, you know, here's a couple of dresses. Try these on. You're going to walk with the class. Okay, I was totally annihilated at graduation. And I did walk with the class. But then after graduation, my mom wanted to take a few pictures. And I'm like, my friends are waiting for me. Can we hurry this up? I mean, this is the kind of, you know, stuff that I would do to my parents, you know. I have a 17-year-old. She's a senior in high school now. Thank God, so far, she is a good kid, you know. I couldn't imagine the heartbreak of what I did to my parents. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, I'm out living on my own, and I was able to get some jobs and work, and finally, eventually, I got my own place. You know, but before my drinking would catch up with me, I would get really nervous because with my jobs, it's kind of hard to drink all night or drink and do drugs all night and then try to make it to work. And so I would quit these jobs before, because I felt really like a lot of pressure, like, oh, they're going to fire me. You know, just this paranoia, this nervousness, you know, just, you know. And because sometimes I wouldn't go in, or sometimes, you know, I had to be at work at 8 or 8:30. I wouldn't roll in till noon without even calling. I mean, it was just, and that's so against the way that my parents taught me. And it was so against the way that I wanted to conduct my life. But, you know, alcoholism was already in the driver's seat, and I didn't even know it. So I'm running with people that were, I felt, were a little bit worse than I was, you know, because I knew that I was starting to go down the slippery slope, but yet I'm still thinking I'm having fun. You know, when the doctor's opinion says, you know, the sensation is so elusive that although they admit it's injurious, talking about alcohol, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. I still think I'm having a good time. But meanwhile, no one else is liking what I'm doing, you know. So anyway, I started working for law firms because I started getting in trouble with the law. And I thought, well, I need somebody on my side here. I need to get this, you know, again, not really wanting to take responsibility. I just want somebody to, you know, show up in court for me and do what they need to do. And but anyway, that ended up being a career for me. I did go back to school because I really liked working in a law firm. So I went back to school and I got my paralegal certificate. And because I never went to college. Oh my gosh, I thought I had turned this off. Excuse me. Never went to college because, you know, I wasn't living at home. And again, that was another disappointment for my parents because my parents are both college educated. My mom was a teacher. My dad, you know, he was very successful in his career. And then there's Liz that, you know, just, you know, wanting to drink. Anyway, so I started working at these law firms, and my parents were thrilled, though, that I had gone back to school. But, you know, deep down, after I got sober, I realized I didn't even earn my paralegal certificate, honestly. You know, I'm going in there, it was night school because I was working during the day, and I'm going in with these big baseball cups full of wine or whatever I wanted to take that night. And I would just get loaded in school, in class. And then when we would have tests, I would just cheat off people. So again, never living honestly, never doing the right thing, never, you know, applying myself, just getting by. And, you know, that does something to your soul. That does something. There's a conflict because I knew that I had a lot of potential, but at the same time, I knew that I was doing as good as I could get, I guess, you know, as I could do because, you know, when you drink like I did, it was hard to even make it to function the next day. And my hangover started lasting 2 and 3 days. And, you know, I couldn't even smoke a cigarette. I smoked back then. I couldn't even smoke a cigarette. And life was really, the physical toll of my alcoholism was definitely rearing its ugly head. And people were telling me, girl, you need to slow down. You need to stop. And if those people started doing that to me, it's like, see ya. Get out of my life. Get out of my face. Leave me alone. You know. And again, talking about we cannot differentiate the true from the false, I'm thinking, you know, if you had my problems, you would drink too. I'm sure you all have heard that when people say that in meetings. And, you know, I just kept, you know, again, the doctor's opinion says that our problems pile up on us and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. My life, you know, I always say it was kind of like the Jerry Springer stuff, you know. I mean, I could have been on the Jerry Springer show with all the shit that was going on in my life. You know, it was just crazy. The people I was running with, and again, I think there was an adrenaline rush with that too because the people were crazy. And I felt living on the edge, you know, staying out all night, doing crazy stuff. You know, got into stealing, got into, you know, just really some crazy stuff. And I was running with some dangerous people. I mean, you know, and their judgment was poor. I mean, they had guns and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this is shit, man, you know. But those people would have never, and they didn't. They didn't help me when I was in trouble, you know. I always thought, oh, they got my back. Well, yeah, they didn't. And anyway, fast forward, I started working at a law firm. I applied for a job. And it almost doubled the salary that I was where I was, you know, at my current job. And so I applied for it, and I got it. And, you know, again, I'm textbook, you know, to a T, but it talks about we build a bright outlook for ourselves and our family, and then we pull it down by a senseless series of sprees. And I remember walking around the block with my sister, and by then my sister had already gotten sober. And I didn't like her as much anymore because, you know, she was starting to get her shit together. Her life was starting to improve. She got married. She started having kids. And I wanted all that. I mean, I couldn't even hold a boyfriend that drank, you know, that drank like me, you know. And talk about being lonely, man. It's lonely when you can't keep people that drink like you around. And so there was a divide between my sister and I. And I remember walking around the block. I was so excited about this job. And she said, you know, Liz, I'm going to tell you something. If you keep drinking the way you're drinking, you're going to not keep that job very long. Well, it was like the knife in the heart, you know. And I said, I would never do that. I would never jeopardize something so good. And anyway, I ended up getting that job. And, you know, my drinking... It's funny because when I would start jobs, I would be real good for maybe that first 3-4 weeks, you know, behave, you know. But then I would start slacking off and I would start the drinking during the week again or, you know, or getting totally irresponsible because I could hold on for a while. But eventually, you know, the absenteeism, you know, they would give me 7 sick days a year. And I think I used all those up, you know, within a matter of, you know, I don't know, a month or two, you know, and that's supposed to kind of last you the whole year. And, you know, and I can remember having this just abnormal fear when I would call in sick because I'd be too hungover to go. I remember then as I would start nursing myself back to health, then I'd think, well, you know, this terror would overtake me. And it'd be like, well, God, I can't go back tomorrow because, you know, what if they fire me? What if tomorrow is the day that they're going to fire me? And my head would just, you know, swirl around with all different scenarios. And, you know, probably I would drink again, probably, to kind of quell that, you know, because that was my off button. I didn't have another off button. My head would just, you know, race. And I got to the point where I couldn't sleep at night. And I would either drink NyQuil or I would, you know, and that's something that I had to get honest with myself about when I got sober, because it was like, well, I never was a daily drinker. But I was doing something to alter my perception of reality, either smoking a joint, drinking the NyQuil, you know, taking something to alter my state of reality and or my perception of reality, just for the relief. You know, I'm no longer drinking because I want to have fun, and I don't know if I ever, I mean, I had some fun times, but my alcoholism really progressed, you know, very rapidly from the time I was a kid all the way till I got sober when I was 31. But anyway, I remember working at this law firm, and I started in April of 92, and July of 93, I went into work one day. It was July 19th of 1993. It was a Tuesday, July 20th is when I got sober. But July 19th, it was a normal day at work, whatever. Went home. I think around 10 o'clock that night, I had one beer. Didn't get, you know, rip-roaring that night. I went into work the next day, July 20th, on that Tuesday. And they called me into the conference room. And so I'm thinking, oh, they want my opinion on, you know, the coffee machines that we're testing out. And wasn't hungover or anything. I was late that day, of course. I was chronically late. Could never show up on time for anything. I had to learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous, how to do stuff like that. And all the partners were sitting around the table, and there was a lady there I didn't know, and the administrator was there also. And they said, have a seat. So I sat down and said, yeah, what's going on? And they said, they all went around, they're, you know, each partner and then the administrator. But they said, we think this is so-and-so from the State Bar of Georgia, and we just think that you have a drinking problem. I mean, I was horrified because I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I got this life at night that I act the fool, but during the day I try to be Miss Professional, you know. And I was the last one to figure out that everybody knew about my alcoholism but me. I never drank on the job. But see, I'd show up and I'd still be hungover, you know, or sick as a dog. I think there was two times when I worked there, that 14-month period, that I drank with them. Because they would take us out. It was a small firm, and now they've grown exponentially. But it was small then, and so they took really good care of us. But they would take us, you know, hey, let's do happy hour on Friday nights. You know, let's shut down a little bit early. They used to take us to the lake. They used to do really some nice functions with us. And they would drink. And I thought, man, I'm not going to, you know, I can't drink with these people. Because I knew that I didn't have the ability to kind of control it. So I would just not do it. And that was another thing that had to be smashed, that belief that I can take it or leave it alone. I'm going out with them. They don't have to chain this stuff down. I'm good. You know, so that, I mean, when I got sober, I had to realize that that was a lie that I would tell myself, that I could take it or leave it alone. Because you could better believe when I would leave those functions, man, I'm going to make up for lost time, you know, with my kind of people that I want to drink with, or I'm going to drink by myself. So I can get comfortable. And I would always leave early. I was always one of the first ones to leave. Now, when I drank, I was always the last one to leave. But when I was, you know, when I wanted to get out of there, it's like, listen, I don't know what was in those nachos, but I got to go. You know, I'm not feeling really good. And they would, you know, okay, see you Monday, Liz. And then that whole weekend I'd be, getting trashed, you know. So anyway, when I went in there, they said, you know, each one of them said some nice things about me, but they said, Liz, look, we know you're a good worker, but you know what? You're slacking. You're just, you know, and you're very irresponsible. We don't know what, you know, we're going out on a limb here. We're thinking maybe there is a drinking deal going on. We don't know. But, you know, you're starting to make a lot of mistakes, and you know, we don't know what to do. We don't know what to do. So the lady from the state bar, she was there because she gave the plan. She said, you either go to treatment, we've got it all mapped out, or go pack up your desk and see you later. Well, you know, the good alcoholic that I am, I mean, I'm like freaking out. Felt like I was in a corner, you know, backed up against the corner. And I said, whoa, you got to let me think about this for a little bit. And I said, you got to give me a couple days. Because I'm thinking, man, I got to go out and get loaded one more time just to make sure this is really what I want to do. And the lady said, yeah, you don't understand. You got to let us know, like, right now what you want to do. What's your decision? And I didn't like that, you know. But I remember I called my brother-in-law because I really wanted to find a way out of this dilemma. I don't like behind door number one, and I don't like behind what's door number two, you know. And I called my brother-in-law, and it was his, like I said, it was his belly button birthday that day. So he called me back because I kept trying to call my sister, the one that got sober. Man, what should I do? And she had gone to Ridgeview. I'm thinking, that's where I want to go. If I have any plan, I'm going to do what she did. And the lady from the state bar was like, no, we've got something down in Statesboro, Georgia, where I want you to go. You're not going to call the shots here. So my brother-in-law called me back because I paged him. Remember the pagers? This was a while ago. And he called me back, and I think he thought I was calling him for his birthday. And of course, it's all about me. It's always been all about me. And you know, hey, you know, I didn't even acknowledge it was his birthday. I got a problem. I'm like, I'm sobbing, I'm crying. They want me to go to treatment, or I'm going to lose my job. Help me! I wanted somebody to rescue me. And he just said on the phone. He goes, you know what? Maybe you should go. Because there were so many times, I mean, I couldn't even, we had gone to a comedy club one night, my sister and my brother-in-law, my boyfriend at the time, and me, and I drove because the boyfriend that I had didn't have a driver's license. You know, I think he had like maybe 7 or 8 DUIs. You know, that's the kind of people I'm attracted to. And so, you know, he was smart because he didn't drive. You know, I didn't drive when I don't have a license, you know, and then get in trouble and go, well, damn, I'm just trying to get from point A to point B, you know, the victim. But I remember when I went out with him one night at a comedy club, I got so trashed that night, I couldn't even find my way out of the parking lot. And my sister-in-law told her husband, stop, you know, try to corral her somewhere in this parking lot, and you drive our car and I'll drive hers. And, of course, I heard rah, 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 the whole way home. I didn't want to hear it. I knew I was messing up, you know, but I couldn't stop. So anyway, okay, so I did take the option to go to treatment. And I went down away from everything up here. And again, that's another lie that I thought is up here. It's the people I'm running with. It's you know, it's the job, the stress of the job. It's this, it's that. And so I went down to Statesboro, was in treatment for, I don't know, I guess 30 days or so. And then when I got out of there, I remember the last thing they told me, they said, you know what, when you leave here tonight, make sure you go to an AA meeting. Because I didn't have, you know, any other support, because here I was out of town. That was 4 hours away. And they said, when you leave here tonight, you make sure you get yourself to a meeting tonight. Do not wait. You know how we do. We procrastinate. Oh, I'm good. I'll do it tomorrow. They said, do not procrastinate. And I was scared enough because I had had enough time to kind of have my mind clear. I had enough time to see that I can't trust myself. And I lived by myself. Even though, you know, I don't know if my sister or my mom, somebody came over and cleaned out everything from my house. Not that there was a whole lot there, but even my NyQuil, everything was gone. But, you know, the store is right around the corner, you know. So I didn't know if I could trust myself, but I did what they told me to do because I had enough fear. I wanted to stay sober a little bit more than I wanted to, you know, go back to that lifestyle. And, you know, and I started going to meetings. I was starting to do a lot of meetings. I went back to work, same job, same law firm. Everybody was really so understanding and sweet. They're like, oh, my God, you're doing so good. 40 days. Oh, my gosh, you're doing great. And I would get these cards, you know, on my desk. you know, oh my gosh, we're so proud of you. Well, all that stopped about, you know, maybe day, I don't know, 50 or something, you know. I mean, it didn't last. And it became harder and harder for me to stay sober, you know, because it's like at the newness of it was all great. You know, my first 30 days I was, you know, in treatment. But sooner or later the bottom was falling out because I didn't know how to live. I didn't have any coping skills, you know, and I'm an emotional person. I'm living on these emotions. You know, the book says that we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I mean, but I didn't know all any of this stuff. So as I'm going to these meetings and stuff, I'm, you know, dumping all my stuff because, man, I had a lot of problems. You know, life was starting to become a major problem. You know, family started being a problem. And that's something that our book says on page 52. It talks about the, you know, kind of life as an untreated alcoholic, whether you're drinking or not. But it talks about having trouble with personal relationships. We can't control our emotional natures. We're a prey to misery and depression. We can't make a living. You know, we're unhappy. You know, and later in the book, too, in A Vision for You, it talks about I would give anything to just have one. I just want the relief. I don't want to go out and get loaded because look what happens to me when I get loaded. But see, I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand that I have a body that's not normal. It's I have this abnormal reaction to alcohol when I put it in me. When I put it in me, I want another one. I want another one, and I want another one. And that, you know, doctor's opinion again. I know I'm saying a lot from the doctor's opinion, but it's so chock full of such good stuff. But the when they talk about the allergy or that abnormal reaction to alcohol, that physical abnormal reaction, it says that explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So all those times when I thought, well, I got too drunk because I didn't eat right or I didn't, you know, I should have eaten before, I should have at least even had bread before I started drinking, or I shouldn't have mixed the cocaine and this, and, you know, just trying to make sense out of the nonsense. And what it is, it just simply states that I'm, you know, I have an allergy to alcohol when I put it in me. It's just that simple. But I didn't know that. And then when I'm not drinking, you know, it feels like I'm doing time. You know, I'm not, over a period of time, I'm not really happy about the sobriety thing. And then I'd give, I'd give my left arm, I'm a lefty, for just to tap one, just to take the edge off. It's too much for me to live without something. So I kept coming to meetings. You know, on the weekends I hated the weekends because it was like I don't even have structured time. I don't even know what to do. So I thank God some of these clubhouses have meetings that start in the morning all the way, although I wasn't getting up in the morning. But, you know, I'd probably hit at 1 o'clock, and then I would just, you know, just hang out there until the 10 o'clock. And sometimes there are midnight meetings. I just didn't feel safe anymore, and I started to really unravel. And everything inside, it was just starting to build up and build up and build up. And at that law firm who treated me so well, they really did. One day I went into work. The administrator came in, and she asked me to do something. And I could just feel I'm getting ready to unleash on this lady. She's not, you know, and she better get the hell out of here right now. And I wasn't that kind to say, get the hell out of here. It was more expletives at the top of my lungs. Because she said, hey, I need you to stop what you're doing and I need you to do this. And I'm like, turned around and I said, I'm not doing that right now. And I always say that when I yelled at her, I would usually reserve that kind of behavior and talk to my family. I was so disrespectful to my family, but I would never do that to people on the outside, especially someone that's signing my checks, you know what I mean? But again, I couldn't control my emotional nature, and all of a sudden, it just, you know, it was like, I mean, the book says that we're like a tornado ripping through the lives of people. And think of a tornado, you know, I was, you know, she was the innocent victim, and I was just this, you know, whirlwind of craziness. And she just was very persistent, though, and she said, Liz, really, I need you to stop what you're doing and do this. And I turned around and I said, I told you I'm not doing that. And I said, and furthermore, I said, get the F out of my office. And she grabbed my arm and I said, and get your effing hands off of me. Who do you think you are? I said, get out of here. And immediately I'm like, holy crap. Because, see, my family, I figured they always have to put up with that, you know. But the outsiders, I immediately grabbed my jacket. I mean, I was like in a rage, and I couldn't push this stuff down. And I remember I grabbed my jacket, grabbed my purse, and one of the other paralegals said, where are you going? I said, man, I'm going to get fucking wasted. And she goes, well, you can't. You don't drink anymore. And I said, you know what? Watch me. I mean, I was just like, get out of the way. And I went to my car, and I don't know how this happened, other than I was just in this, probably like a blackout rage. I mean, I could not believe, you know, that had just went down. But instead of going to the liquor store, and there I worked at the King Building, the King and Queen off of 400. There's, you know, even a Publix, for crying out loud, is right there. But instead, I found myself at 8111. And I went there, I went to 8111 quite a bit, and there was a girl there that I had seen for probably 2 weeks. She was kind of new on the scene, and she was coming with her husband. She was young, and I remember hating her. I hated anybody that was happy. I hated anybody that, you know, maybe disturbed me with some truth. It's like, I don't need to talk to them. Man, shut up, you know. Or when they would share about stuff like that. Oh, no, I'm not listening to that. I want somebody, oh, Liz, it's okay. You know, keep coming back. You're all right. I wanted that kind of soft and warm and you know. But she was disturbing me when she would share because there was a lot of truth there. And it made me uncomfortable. So, and I would talk about her in the parking lot, too. You know, man, what a bitch, man. I can't believe that girl. Where did she come from? You know, this and that and the other. Well, who do I go to when I am, like, on the brink of homicidal, suicidal, crazy train? I go to her. But, of course, I hang on. I go to the meeting first. I don't ask her. I just want to be sure again, you know, is this really, really what I want to do? And I remember after the meeting, she sponsored a lot of people. And I remember going up to her. I said, listen, can I talk to you? I'm scared, you know. I mean, and she said, yeah, I'll talk to you. So I waited and waited. And finally, she took me out on the porch. And she said, what's going on? I said, man, I don't know. I said, I don't know what's wrong with me. I haven't had a drink in almost 10 months. And I am just like batshit crazy. She goes, what's going on? I said, I don't know. I said, I fell apart at work. I exploded at work. I can't go back to that job. And I said, I feel like, I mean, at least when I was drinking, I never lost a job drinking. I would always quit before, you know, they'd catch up with me. But here I am, sober, almost a year, and I can't function. I'm biting people's heads off. I don't even want to be around my family. My mom's leaving these nasty messages on the phone, on the answering machine. Again, this was a long time ago. Saying, you know, where are you? Are you up to your old tricks again? Because I was working all day, going to 8 o'clock meeting at night, going to a 10 o'clock, anything just to keep me going. And by the time I would get home, I mean, she would just want to say, hey, how was your day and stuff? Oh, no, I'm out, you know, trying to save my ass. And I'm thinking, doesn't she know how hard this is for me to do this? What the hell? So I said to my sponsor, she ended up being my sponsor, I said, can you help me? Because she said, Liz, everything you're describing sounds like you're just walking around with a good case of untreated alcoholism. That's all. I'm thinking, how can you be so calm and say something like that? Because you don't understand. I'm not drinking. See, I was thinking it was all about the drinking. And I'm not drinking anymore, man. I've got more problems now than I did when I remember when I was drinking. And she said, I know. See, I never opened up this book, ever. Never, you know. I would hear people, you know, sharing meetings and stuff. I just didn't hear about alcoholism. Maybe it was being said, I don't know, but I didn't hear it until I heard it from her. And now I know that that's not true, but, you know, you hear when you hear and you see when you see and all that good stuff. But So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yeah." And if I say no, what? That means you're not going to probably help me. And she said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to convict you of alcohol?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "All right, this is what I want you to do." She started giving me good orderly direction from the beginning. And the most important thing was she got me into this book, and she said, "What I want you to do is I want you to start at the beginning of this book and get a pen or a pencil or a highlighter out and start identifying your own experience to what this book has to say, because that's all you came in here with." You know, because I would hear some people's experience and it would not really tally up with mine. But she said, "That doesn't matter. This is what I want you to do. Relate your own experience to what this book has to say. And, you know, I want you to call me. And this is the time I want you to call me every day. Not, you know," it was 5:30 at night. She says, "Not 5:45, not 5:25, but 5:30. She was very precise. Because guess what? The directions in the book are very precise and very exact. So she asked me if I was praying. And I said, "Yeah." But again, I mean, there was no connection with God or anything. And she said, "Well, I want you to pray, and I want you to hit your knees in the morning, and I want you to get on your knees at night, and I want you to ask God to help you do whatever is necessary to stay sober in the morning, and then at night, I want you to thank Him for what He did for you." She said, "It doesn't mean that your life is going to be magically all of a sudden, you know, what is that, unicorns and rainbows, you know." But she said, "You know, I can guarantee you, if you follow these directions, you will never have to feel the way you're feeling right now." And I was feeling like crap, you know. Again, suicidal and homicidal, and I'm not kidding. I also explained to her what had happened at my job, and she said, "Do you want to keep that job?" And I said, "I don't know how I'm going to, because I showed my ass there. I don't know how that's going to work." And she said, "This is what you're going to do. If you want that job, this is what you're going to do." And she told me what I needed to do. Of course, that whole night I didn't get any sleep because I'm like terrified. Because I'm like, oh my gosh. I had never cleaned up messes in my life. Ever. You know, like a cat in a litter box, covering it up. You know, hoping nobody would know or see or whatever. And again, my alcoholism was cornering me. You know, it had cornered me years before I was even realized it. So the next day I go and I ate crow. My sponsor says, "You eat crow and you eat it when it's still warm." And that was my first time doing that. And it was pretty hard to choke up the words to say, because I was, again, I was terrified. She goes, "You pray before you do it." Okay. And I did the best I could with what I knew and what I had. And I followed directions for the first time. And I ended up working at that law firm for 7 years. After I did that. And I don't know when it was, maybe a year or two later, the administrator that I had cussed out, I remember we worked pretty closely together, and I was sitting in her office one day, and we were busy going over some financial records or something, and just out of the blue, she said, because we would have a good time, we'd go out to lunch, we'd go out to dinner and stuff like that. We formed a really pretty special friendship. And just out of the blue, she said, she had one son that was a little bit older than me. And she said, "You know what?" She goes, "You are like the daughter that I never had." And I turned around and I looked at her and I said, "What?" And she goes, "You are like the daughter that I never had." And I mean, that's just, you know, I mean, a gift. She got cancer. She was way older than me. She ended up getting cancer. And I would go see her. She got in really bad shape after it took its toll on her, and she ended up passing away. And she's buried up here in Arlington Cemetery, and I still go, and I'll go pray the rosary there at her grave or something. But I'll go and visit her because she had a profound impact on my life, and I didn't even know it. You know, that was my turning point. When it says we stood at the turning point, that seemed like, aside from when they intervened on me, which I thought at that moment, oh my God, this is the worst day ever. And then when I blew up like that, I thought, oh my God, this is the worst day ever. But it really was the catalyst. All that stuff was what had really, I was standing at the turning point, and that has determined the choices that I make and have made and continue to make in my life today. Because if I had done something different, I don't know if I'd be sober. I don't know if I'd be alive. But anyway, getting back to my sponsor, she took me through these steps. When I started becoming consistent with those simple directions, I started, she took me through these steps, and I remember after she took me through step one, and she took these steps with me to show me what to do. And we did it in the course of a day. And I know that sounds crazy, but you know what? That's what our founders did. And I followed the directions in this book, and she showed me exactly the time parameters of this thing. Next, you know, they tell us next. They do tell us, you know, okay, we do this, we do that. But something happened. But I can remember after like step one or step two, I'm like, okay, I'm not feeling anything. Again, still a very feeling-driven person. So I'm not feeling anything. And she goes, you know what? It tells me in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you know. So you're not going to get it. Just like when I drank, I never felt satisfied or complete with just taking a couple swigs. You know, it was always, you know, till the last drop of the bottle and then some. But that's when I would experience, you know, what I was looking for in the bottle sometimes. But anyway, she taught me how to, and I'm not going to go through the steps tonight. I usually do, but I got the 5-minute warning. But I guess God just wanted me to say what it was, share what I shared tonight. But something happened to me that, like I said, when I first started speaking tonight, that keeps me coming back here. You know, I've got a lot of responsibility now. My parents are aging. It sucks to see, you know, that my dad's got dementia. My mom's not where she used to be. The holidays are coming up. My mom used to do the holidays so beautifully. So I get kind of sad, you know, because things are not the way they used to be. But I am a responsible daughter to them. As I told my dad when I made amends to my father, my mom didn't want to hear it, so I couldn't force myself on her like I wanted to. But I remember going to my dad, and I made a financial amends to my father, and I also told him, I said, you know, Dad, I know I wasn't the daughter that you wanted me to, you know, that you raised me to be. And now I'm in charge of their finances. I used to steal from my dad, you know, credit cards, money, his change that he would leave on the dresser, take his credit cards and put them back in his, you know, go charge whatever and then go put them back in his wallet. I mean, I was just a mess. Or borrow money from my dad, ask Dad, my insurance is due. But really, it was just because I, you know, didn't have any money to party on. Dad, my insurance is due. I really, you know, but I swear I'll pay you on Friday when I get paid. That never happened. So now I'm in a position where, I mean, I joke with my dad. I said, Dad, I balance the checkbook to the penny like you used to do. And he gives me a little smile. I mean, he, again, the cognitive awareness is a little bit there, but a little bit gone. I have a daughter that's 17 that's just, you know, so beautiful. My husband, you know, he's a wonderful guy. In fact, he just called me just a minute ago. He travels a lot. But we got a good thing going. And when I'm spiritually fit, life is wonderful. When I get off the beam and it's everybody else's fault and people start getting on my nerves, the solution's the same. But sometimes my mind wants to say, oh, I'm too far gone this time. What an order. I can't go through with it. But I just put one foot in front of the other and I continue to, you know, climb this, you know, my way out of a hole. And, you know, they say if you want to get out of a hole, stop digging. And I stop digging and I start getting into action again. I no longer work in the legal field right now, which, you know what, God really put me in this beautiful ministry. It's a nonprofit ministry that I work for, and I do Bible studies and retreats for men and women that suffer from the negative effects of abortion. And in fact, in January, I'm going to go speak at the U.S. Supreme Court for the March for Life. I'm going to speak, and I'm able to share from the podium now because my daughter knows that I am also post-abortive. I've had abortions back in the day, and it really messed me up. But now I got healing for that. So, I mean, God is just really so wonderful, and I keep seeking Him. Continues to be my job, is to continue to seek Him, and He just shows me what I need to do. And, you know, I guess I'll stop with that. I'm just so grateful to be sober. You know, it's more than just not drinking for me. You know, I have a life that is beyond everything that I was searching for in the drinking. I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's lasting and it's real. So thanks for letting me share tonight. Again, Tim and Tim, thank you for inviting me here. I will see you guys around. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Liz. I knew that was going to be good. Will you give out the chips, Tinsley, please?
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Liz. That was great. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer the white chip. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time. All right, after 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days? All right. Anybody else got 30 days? About 90 days for red chip. All right. Anybody else got 90 days? Anybody got 6 months? We have a yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. All right. Anybody got 1 year or multiples of years? Any birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on the white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
All right. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Battle.